Hello, and welcome to Arcane Connection. Tonight's episode is a slightly unusual one, is it not, Tom?
It's the most fan demanded one in history.
Yep, somebody actually asked if we could do another episode. And so, therefore, I don't know who it was. Can you look up the name so we can say thank you?
Eorvad.
No one has ever shown the slightest interest. My own girlfriend, Becky. Dr. Smith has turned to me, and when I suggested that I would make another copy of Arcane Connection, she said, "Hello and welcome to Arcane Connection." No, Chris, nobody wants that. She has been so unkind to suggest that Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory's TV show Fun with Flags is more interesting than me and Tom talking about Ars Magica. So,
Snappy flags can be very interesting.
Unless it's the Somerset flag, which was designed, of course, by one of our players and dear friends, Ed Woods. So, anyway, let's start at the beginning. Did we find out who it was who asked for an episode?
As I said, Eorvad.
Hi there. Well, it's lovely that you were kind enough to ask us, and we have attempted to provide one. Tom, we're not in the same building tonight. This again is a bit of a first for us, isn't it?
Here we are attempting the whole over the internet distributed business. Usually it works better in CJ's elite recording studio, but
Yeah, in my carefully built recording studio here in Cheltenham. Okay, well tonight Tom and I are separated by a rainstorm and a mile or two, but we're going to talk over the internet and we're going to attempt, and we're also trying a new method of recording. We're recording on Zoom, so this will either work or not work at all. But thank you to everyone who supported the podcast over the last decade when it has appeared and not appeared. Last time we said we would be talking about Storyforce tonight, and I'm really looking forward to doing that episode, but we had such a response that Tom is still busy adding up the numbers and reading things and looking at stuff. So we are going to come back to that for our next episode, aren't we, Tom?
that, yes.
In the meantime, we're going to start with something else which is going on this week and which I was surprised to learn about yesterday, which is that Atlas have once again released everything, pretty much, for 5th edition through the bundle of holding. Now, just so you, in case you did not know, in the future, in the near future, there is going to be a revised edition of 5th edition. It won't change the rules, it won't change anything much, but it will include all the errata and everything from the other books that's really useful. And it's going to be beautiful, and it's going to be a really nice book, but it's going to
Have
be.
new artwork.
However, it will be completely compatible with everything in this bundle. So if you
Yes.
don't have either of the two bundle of holdings, or at least, yeah, it is absolutely compatible, isn't it? So I would encourage you to pick them up now, because although the print books are beautiful and are lovely, and many of them actually have my name on them, quite a lot of them, and most of them have Tom's name inside as a playtester, we still think you should pick up the PDFs. Because they're just really handy in this day of virtual tabletops, etc. Right, so first things first, Tom, you're going to play Ars Magica and you've bought the bundle of holding. There's two bundles of holdings. Do you just quickly want to go through what the bundles that are available this week are?
So if you click on bundleofholding.com, the one that they're going to first thing they'll show you is the Ars Magica 5 More Magic, which is originally launched in 2016. But if you want the core rulebook, you need to scroll down and it will point you to the Ars Magica 5 bundle. You see the highlighted text for that. The Ars Magica 5 bundle, if you get the starter collection, that gives you the 5th edition core book, Covenants, which is the book with lots of rules for making your cover more exciting. Houses of Hermes True Lineages, the Apprentice's Book, and the Living Covenant. If you get the bigger collection, you get the other Houses of Hermes books, the Land of the Lily, which is the Tribunal book for Normandy, the Classic Adventure, the Broken Covenant of Calabares, and Tales of Mythic Europe, which is a bunch of scenarios.
Right,
The
well,
more magic one gives you a whole bunch of ones to do with variant things of magic. So ancient magic for all sorts of weird magics, rival magic, and hedge magic. So you get the mysteries. So it's giving you lots and lots of different things to do with different forms of magic. And in the bonus collection, you've got things like Hermetic Projects and Transform Mythic Europe, which give you ideas to really, really do massively impressive things. And the scenarios book, Tales of Power for High-Powered Magi, which is very interesting.
Right, yeah. But we read these books over 20 years, and there's an awful lot of them. And if I had been told to sit down and read that, I would have just blanked immediately. I would have just gone, no, can do. This is not a game. This is a PhD. In fact, most PhDs only have 100,000 words you have to produce. So let's say you read 10 times more. That's still only 1 million words. And if you've got read everything for Ars Magica 5, I think I worked out it was about 7 million words. Is that right? I could have miscalculated, but anyway, it's a
You could have
ridiculous.
miscalculated, but on the other
There are
hand,
hardback books. Nobody ever should try and read all of them. The authors might have done it, but that's because we are not ordinary mortals. We are creatures who are kept in a basement, like mushrooms, and fed on a strange mixture of virgin's blood and alcohol and orichalcum by David Chart, who occasionally appears and commands us with mighty magics. No, that's not true. No, actually, we're just incredibly dedicated as a bunch of authors. But we did produce a lot of books, didn't we?
you did, Christian.
So the thing is that when you want to start playing Ars Magica, first rule of Ars Magica is, what's the first rule of Ars Magica, Club Tom?
Oh, is it roll the stress die, and if it's a one, roll again and double it?
That would be a really useful first rule because that's a core die mechanic. But actually, the first thing is don't read the books. Or rather, read the bit of the books that interest you at that time. And if you're running your first campaign, you only need one book, and that is Ars Magica 5th Edition by Jonathan Tweet, Mark Reinhagen. They were the original authors. David Chart did the 5th edition. And it's a lovely book. Unfortunately, it's not as pretty as modern RPG books in some ways, and it's very densely written. There's not a lot of unnecessary text. There is, I've realized, I do you realize, I don't think I've ever read the fluff text, the stories, and they are quite good. But the book opens, chapter one introduction, with a very simple explanation. If you read the little story at the top of the page, which is mercifully brief because I tend to skip those things, and then you flip down and read through the next two or three pages. There's even a glossary. I mean, you probably won't need to read the glossary at the beginning. You'll read that later or look it up when you need it. But one page covers the dice, and one page covers the structure of the book, and the very basic ideas are summarized in a paragraph. And that's pretty much all you need to know to play Ars Magica. And what do you think, Tom? Does that seem like realistic and useful advice to you?
Yep. Once you've worked out how stress dice and bosh dice work, you've got enough to run the game.
Now let's assume that you've played play not Call of Cthulhu. Let's go for a game which has got multiple books, Dungeons and Dragons. In
Yep.
that, from the very first, well, not from the first edition, but from AD&D in 1979, the Monster Manual, the Player's Handbook, and the Dungeon Master's Guide have been the core, and anything else is supplementary, really. You might want all those extra books, all those extra classes, all those extra frilly bits, but you don't need them. And it's exactly the same here. You only really need the one book to play Ars Magica. And when you first play, start with that one book. If you let your players go off and start using stuff from ancient magic, even the Houses of Hermes books, which are fantastic for giving you the houses, real depth. Don't. For your first campaign, say core book only. We're just going to use this first book initially. Buy the others while they're cheap, and so you've got them because you will want them eventually. But for your first campaign, concentrate on the core rule book. There is enough in there to last you many lifetimes of casting spells, imaginary game spells, I hasten to add, and playing happily in the order in the order of Hermes. So, what's Ars Magica actually about, Tom? In two sentences.
It's a game being in the main about gentlemen majors and lessons. So effectively, it's about the lives of wizards, what they do to improve their arts, the adventures they have, and the...
Yeah. Chapter 2. If you've bought a
place where they live, and the various characters who populate it all.
Exactly. Chapter 2 deals with this, the Order of Hermes. If you've bought a bundle of holding, yeah, the biggest danger is that you will leave it on your PDF bookshelf and never look at it. And never try and play it. So my advice to you is start immediately. Don't waste time. Find, ask around, see who's interested. Schedule a game for next Wednesday. If you do that, if you start playing, it'll either work or it'll fail, but at least you'll know what it is that you're trying, yeah? Now, admittedly, the rules for Ars Magica can be a bit obtuse. Is that a fair summary, Tom?
It can take a bit of reading and a bit of parsing.
So what we're going to do is we're going to look at Chapter 2 now, The Order of Hermes. The Order's history is interesting, but most characters aren't going to care about it. The 12 founders, well, they were the 12 people who set up the houses. The crises in the Order, again, none of your players are going to need to know that. You can read it later. But for the moment, skip to page 11, which is an overview of the 12 houses, going through page 11 and 12. That's true on both the print version and the PDF, at least on the versions I've got. And you'll find there are 12 houses, House Bjornir, House Bonisargus, House Creamon, House... I would suggest copying out those two pages, printing them off, taking a screen grab, whatever it takes, and showing them to your players and saying, which house is your magician going to come from? Because they are like character classes. They basically shape and define your character's political allegiances, but they also shape the kind of magic they're going to be good at. Then on page 13, there's a bit on covenants, the Code of Hermes, and the Peripheral Code. That is actually interesting. If you're going to start your first session with the Magi becoming magicians at a tribunal and swearing the Oath of Hermes, then you might want to have a quizzitor in character go through the stuff on page 13 and 14. But, you know, to do that would be a good start to a game. Page 15 tells you a little bit about medieval Europe, and then essentially you're back onto characters and creating characters. So far we've gone through 17 pages, but I think there's only two of them your players need to know. And as long as you've got understood the dice and a little bit at the beginning, you're pretty much well on your way to running your first session, aren't you, Tom?
I mean, certainly you could run things, but not when it gets to the magic.
Okay, don't worry about that yet. For the next part along, page 17, in a game, some players will be playing their magicians, some players will be playing companions who are knights, foresters, bards, fairy princesses, whatever, other characters who are not magicians, and everybody will have a grog. And a grog is a bit part character who they jump in with occasionally and play when their character is doing something else, who are basically the bodyguards of the party and the cannon fodder, and who bravely and nobly give their lives for the sake of the magicians. Well, maybe not voluntarily. So although we talk about having three types of characters and what's called troop play, and it's also assumed, actually, also that the referee will change from time to time. But don't worry about that for your first campaign. For your first campaign, just run it yourself. The person who's read the book can run it. Unless you've got a player who knows Ars Magica, in which case they can take over. And Tom and I, we just got into the habit of running adventures with one another for an entire campaign, didn't we?
We did, yes.
And I had a character in the campaign, and so did Tom. Obviously, my character never took part in anything I ran, and Tom's character never took part in his adventures. They were left in their laboratory. Now, in Ars Magica, you don't get better by adventuring. This is a very important concept. Adventure XP are never generous enough to actually make up for what you could have learned if you'd been a good little wizard and stayed in the library. So, why would you go out adventuring? Well, the odds are that you won't. This is the game where character generation never ends. And the trick to becoming a 10th level wizard, or a character like Hua Flumbo, who could destroy an army with a click of his fingers, level the mountains of Wales, and fly amongst the clouds if he wanted to, I expect, you only become as powerful as an archmage by spending a lot of time not going out on adventures, but staying at home doing additional character generation stuff. Now that sounds counterintuitive. Why play a game where the protagonists, a lot of the time, are not actually going out adventuring? And the answer is very simple, because one Magus is the focus for any given adventure, and the other players play their companions. Perhaps allow two Magi, though that can be overpoweringly powerful for most adventures. This is not a game where you go on and just kill things and take their stuff. This is a game about scientists. Anything a modern scientist can do or might do, go for to an expedition to a remote country to study a creature, attempt to find a strange geological anomaly and understand its meaning, encounter alien beings in the forest and try and communicate with them. Fairies, not UFOs, but they're very similar. Whatever it may be that a modern scientist might be up to, try and develop a new breakthrough that changes the laws of science, or in this case, the laws of magic. Anything a scientist can do, your magician can do. So your magician's going to spend a lot of time in the laboratory not being played. So during those two adventures, you play a companion. Tom, tell us about companions.
Companions are characters who are reasonably powerful and that they can have lots and lots of virtues and flaws. But they're not wizards, so they don't have the gift, they can't cast spells, they might have a supernatural ability or two, but they can form quite powerful roles in society. They don't affect people by being weird and spooky and supernatural necessarily. So they can actually get on with people and do a lot more social things and interact with the world outside much better than wizards.
So, try and avoid having your Magi sent on adventures, but realize they will be sent on some. And that the kind of adventures that your Magi goes on will be determined by something called story flaws and personality flaws, which is what the story guide or referee uses to drag you into adventures. Really strong, important piece of information here. The players will try and use any opportunity to send all their magicians on every adventure. Now, if you send all of your magicians on every adventure, various things can happen. Firstly, they might find it very easy to complete the adventure because they'll have a wide range of magical powers and they will simply make their way through everything along the way. Secondly, they will accidentally burn down a local town or harbour, as my characters invariably do, while trying to attempt the riot that they have provoked by their sheer weirdness. You see, it's not just that people are superstitious and frightened of magicians. In fact, magicians were treated with a certain degree of healthy respect, and even witches were rarely persecuted in the 13th century. There's no the witch trials are much later. So in this period, practicing magic is seen as being you being a superstitious idiot or a huckster, or much like we regard people who say they're magicians today, actually. There's the church is skeptical of them, but they might actually really be scientists doing something, deeply important. So they might treat them with respect, but they're unlikely to accuse them of blasphemy as long as they're not, actually wearing satanic regalia and in worshipping the devil. So magicians are not hated because of what they do, they're hated because of what they are. And what they are is individuals tainted with the gift. They don't fit into medieval society. Covenants treat women, people of any sexual orientation, generally, any background whatsoever, any ethnicity, even women are treated with respect and as sodales. It's a very democratic, modern society, which puts that part of the setting at complete odds with the rest of the background. And one of the reasons for that is that all of the characters have this shared flaw or freak, which allows them to learn magic, something called the gift. Is that a fair summary, Tom?
Real trouble is the gift just gets in the way of you trying to live your life.
Yeah, the gift scares people. If you've got the gift, you might make the milk curdle. You might put the hens off laying. Ordinary people cross themselves. When your shadow crosses their door, they might go to the church and pray for salvation. You know, people are scared of magicians. They're scared of what they don't understand. And unless your character has got a virtue called the gentle gift, which means that they feel like a normal human being, or is inoffensive to animals, which means at least, you know, cats and dogs don't freak out whenever they see them, and goose don't hiss and bark and do whatever geese do. It's really hard for a group of magicians to go anywhere. They can't find anywhere to stay in a city. They might be denied access to the city in case they're vagabonds or mercenaries or, you know, even worse than that, something like thespians, theatrical performers. So therefore, magicians need to work through human agents. I'm sorry, human, mortal, non-magical agents. Is that a fair way of putting it? Hence, companions and grogs.
Yes.
Okay, so we've got that far. We've explained the basic principles of the game, and we've explained for rules reasons or for game balance reasons, send one magician. The game will be so much easier. Trying to work out half a dozen magicians all trying to cast spells when each of them's got unique powers and unique abilities will drive you mad, especially for the first session. Secondly, when you're designing an adventure, go for moral questions as well as physical challenges. Go for geographical challenges, go for environmental things like it rains heavily. Does the character catch illness? Do they? What can they do about the rats infesting the widow's cottage? Go for stories from folklore. Get yourself a copy of something like the Reader's Digest Book of Strange Stories and Amazing Facts, or the Reader's Digest Book of Folklore, both of which you can find quite cheaply. Any book on British folklore, and there are large numbers of them that are now available at Gutenberg, Project Gutenberg, or other online free sources. Because they're out of print. They date back to the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Grab yourself a folklore collection. Now, you might be playing in Hungary, or you might be playing in France, but assuming that your native language is Anglophone, then, you know, just pick up an English folklore book and adapt it. The story of the stone circle known as the Seven Maidens, it's from Cornwall, but it could easily be reset in Brittany. Or parts of any part of Western Europe. You could change the nature of the stone circle to some statues and place it on the near the ruins of Ephesus or near Ephesus. It's actually still an active city, I suppose, in the 13th century, but on the coast of Turkey. You could change the form from stones, standing stones, to trees. Which were once witches dancing on a mountainside, as the Seven Maidens were, and the seven sinister trees in the Black Forest take the same form. You can take your folk legend and change it to anywhere, but find a story you like, and don't worry too much about plotting out. It's not D&D. You're not going to be plotting out huge adventures. What you need to do is know what the challenges the players will face, and then they'll have so many resources available to them to try and overcome those four or five challenges you've set up that they will write the story for you. Does that sound fair to you, Tom? Pardon me. I also can't hear Tom at the moment. Tom, can you hear me?
Yes, Christian, sir, still continuing on.
Okay, I wasn't sure there if we'd. Right, so going back to the rule book, flip through to page 20, character templates. The character templates will tell you exactly, you know, they give you example characters. Now, several of these, in fact, I think all of these are available to download from www.grandtribunal.org. But when I put this episode up, I will try and find the links and put them up for you. So you can just download the character sheets without having to fill them in again. That's really useful because these characters that are given in the book are great examples and are fantastic ones to start with. It even explains how they've been designed and the customization notes so you can change them around. Now, You might take one look at these and think, what on earth's going on? Well, to start with, characteristics. Let's look at the Berserker on page 21. Int minus two, perception minus one, presence minus one, communication minus one. You might need to write down what the characteristics are. You'll find that a few pages earlier. But the first thing that got me when I tried to learn Ars Magica back in the 90s and why I basically gave up was I was used to a scale that went from 3 to 18, 3d6 stats, or Traveller that went from 2 to 12. Is that right, Tom? Yeah, that's correct. And
Skatings.
I took one look at these stats and I thought, minus 5 to plus 5, my head's not getting this. What I didn't realize was actually it's exactly the same as a 3d6 curve, except that rather than 3 being minus 3 or minus 4 or minus 5, or 0 being minus 5 and 21 being plus 5, or however it works in D&D. In D&D, I think a 12 is naught, 9 to 12 is naught, isn't it? 13 to 14 is plus 1, is that right? 15, 16 plus 2,
You're
7.
thinking of AD&D sort of things. These
Yeah.
days, fifth ed, it's nice and easy. Every multiple of 2 over 10 is a plus 1.
So 12 is
Every
plus.
2 points below 10 is a
Okay, so that's how it works nowadays.
1.
But it's exactly the same. You don't really need the stat number because you only use the modifier. Once you've created it, how often do you use your strength of 18? You don't. You use the plus four, don't you? Is that's the
Exactly.
So if you want to, you can convert them across to a 3d6 numbers. So int minus two would be 4 points below 10. So it's int six in AD&D terms. Perception eight. Presence eight. He's not a charmer, is he? Communication eight. Strength plus 16. Stamina plus 14. Dex plus 14. Quickness plus 12. So if you look up what the characteristics are, so you can tell the difference between, say, presence and communication and dex and quickness, that's a good idea. But you can quickly, mentally, just multiply those numbers by two and subtract or add from 10, and you can convert it to D&D in your head. Now, the way you actually design stats is you use what are called pyramid points. For the moment, I'm not even going to bother with that. There's loads of simple examples you can give, but let's just teach people how to use a character sheet they've been given. Their size, a size plus one guy is big, a size minus one guy is a large child, a teenager, or something. A size plus two guy is almost the size of a horse. He's massive. He's a mahoosive, as Becky would say. He's a giant. A size minus two person is the size of a hobbit, basically, or a small child, I
Yes.
think. So size, that's all it means. The larger you are, the harder you are to hurt. Age is important in the Middle Ages because, of course, as everybody knows, you get to the age of 25 and die of dysentery. That's a joke. Don't write in and tell me. I know full well that people live 3 score and 10 if they got past childhood mortality. There was a lot of younger deaths in the 13th century. And it's partly because, I've forgotten his name, died last week, historian of violence. Who was the guy who wrote the History of Violence, Tom?
I can't remember what you mean.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. But basically, he proved that British society had been getting safer with the exception of war years. Periods like the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars and the end of World War II in the 1950s, when there's an upswing in sexual assault and physical assault because loads of squaddies are coming home desensitized. But the majority, decade on decade, there has been a fall in crime, and especially in homicide, since the 13th century, which from our records was the high point of homicides. Do you know why the 13th century was the high point of homicides?
Lots of magical characters.
Ars Magica characters, yeah, because they're all because the Berserker is one of the first examples you learn, and clearly, as he goes around with a pole axe, it was very
I
dangerous.
expect you're going to say it's like the Barons' War and
Well, actually, the real reason was that in the 13th century, in the 1170s, King Henry II sent out, sorry, not King Henry, King Henry I sent out sheriffs to record common law. But by the 1220s, common law, the laws of the land have begun to be set. The assizes are beginning to convict people. So if you murdered someone, it was more likely you'd be found and hanged. So the reason why there is more homicide in the 13th century than the 12th century is because we have records for homicide in the 13th century. I can't remember what it's called. What's it called when you only when you name something and start to pay attention to it, does it become a statistical thing? It happens in
It's a
medicine.
well-known observation in social sciences, yeah.
So anyway, the thing is that since that time, British society has got safer. And one of the reasons for that is that medicine, now, the Enlightenment view of medieval medicine was pop these leeches down your codpiece and you'll be right as rain in the morning. Or is that Blackadder? I'm not sure. But that was pretty much the Enlightenment view of the Middle Ages, that life was nasty, short, and brutal, not nasty, brutish, and short, to misquote Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan. But, the natural condition of man was one of misery, and everybody wallowed around in the mud. And even Monty Python took the mickey out of this. But actually, the 13th century is the high Middle Ages. It's an age of romance, an age of literacy. The population of Britain is the highest it will be until the Tudor era, because, of course, it's almost, well, it's not, it's more than decimated. It's decimated three times over. A third of the population died during the Black Death. In the middle of the next century. So this is a high point in our history. And during this time, medicine is actually getting better. And the reason that a lot of people died in the 13th century, nowadays it's always, did you know that if you're a woman in England, you're as likely to be killed by your mother as you are by a stranger?
Be fair, your mother's no longer got a lot more reasons to do it.
Mothers kill their daughters, and daughters kill their mothers actually more, almost not quite as much as lovers. Your husband or your lover is the most likely person to kill you, or your upset ex, but your mother is a pretty high, and oh, your daughter. So the answer to this is never talk to your family. Clearly, it's the only way to be safe. But going back to the plot, from the 13th century onwards, violence declined because medicine got better. So at the beginning of the century, anybody who was injured in a fight might well collect, get septicemia and die. You got infected from the wound, you died. So almost anything, any minor scratch or any kind of injury could kill you. Is that true in Ars Magica? No, because it would be bloody miserable as a game if it was, wouldn't it?
To be fair, you people tend to have a mages come along and stick big healing bonuses on you if you get into serious scraps. If you absolutely take the rules as written very seriously, and go through wound recovery, it is possible if somebody's got a low stamina or you take
They take a
the
life
fragile
hit.
constitution flaw, these things could happen.
I've seen characters die from falling off their horses. It was extremely unlucky, but
Yes.
I've never seen a character, botch a woodworking role, get a splinter, and die from an infection, but that is entirely possible within the rules. So it would have to be a fairly heavy botch. Anyway, enough of this. Let's get back to the plot. So, next thing down. You'll see decrepitude and warping. Decrepitude is a measure of how old your character is. Unless you've been playing the campaign for over a year, you don't really need to worry about that. Even if we've just finished a 5-year campaign and only had one character die of decrepitude, haven't we?
Yes.
He only died yesterday. RIP Dearest, much missed. He was Phil's character, who was a brilliant orator, scribe, but who started off as Sergeant of the Grogs. And he liked to teach the kids how to read and write using somewhat brutal methods. Anyway, warping. Warping is when magic spells are cast on you and they slowly change you into something not quite human. Don't worry about that for the moment. You don't need to know about it because you're probably not going to have any powerful magic to start with. Virtues and flaws. That is the key bit. The referee should read the virtues and flaws for every character sheet they are handing out. Now, there are a lot of virtues and flaws, and you don't need to know the rest, but you need to know the ones you're giving to the players, or that the players have chosen if you're letting them make their own characters, because those are the ones that will come up in your game, And if you've got the rules for Wrathful Miner in front of you, or Short Attention Span, or Berserk, then you don't have to keep checking back. Now, fortunately, all of the maths on these character sheets is already covered, and none of those actually really need you to look at anything. Personality traits, they're straightforward. +3 means you're really angry, you're really brave, +3. You're fairly loyal, but nowhere near as loyal as you are brave and angry, and you're massively disobedient. Now, how can you be obedient -2 means you don't like being told what to do. So how can you be loyal and disobedient? Well, actually, it's quite easy. You might have the best interest of the Magi at heart, but be unwilling to follow their orders when they're bloody stupid and the Magi are going to get themselves into trouble. So with that in mind, you can be loyal and disobedient. Now, note I say disobedient. It says obedient -2. If you were angry -2, you'd be really laid back. If you were brave -2, you'd be really cowardly. If you were loyal -2, you'd be looking for an opportunity to sell out the party. And if you were obedient +2, you'd do what you were told. So personality traits, you can change them during the game to your conception of the character. In between adventures, you can just change them to whatever you want to reflect changes in the character. You do not need to actually follow any kind of rules, and you don't need to roll them particularly, though you can. So personality traits, interesting. Look them up if you've got time. It's not going to stop you enjoying the game if you don't. Combat. There is a whole chapter on combat later on. And combat is not like other games, is it, Tom?
Me not.
So my advice is do read the combat chapter, make up a couple of grogs, try fighting a couple of grogs, and you will learn how combat works. Now, once you've actually gone through that, oh no, hang on, soak is armor. I'll explain the combat things just quickly. Initiative, you add to a d10, high wins, and so everybody rolls, creates an initiative total. You go down from the highest initiative to the lowest, everybody takes one action. If you're attacking, you roll a dice, add your attack, the defender rolls a dice, adds their defense. If the attack number is higher than the defense, it hits, and you add the difference to the damage. And that tells you the damage total. You then subtract the soak of the character you've hit, and that gives you a number of wound points which get through. Look at wound penalties and look at the numbers in brackets. So if you do 9 points, that's in the range 7 to 12. So the character would tick the -3 wound. They would be horribly injured and take a -3 to all their dice rolls until they were healed. That's all there is to it, really, isn't there? Is that a fair summary of combat, Tom?
Same part.
And abilities. It's worth reading through the abilities. Look for the ones which you don't understand. Do you know what guile means? If you don't, look up guile. I can't see any others there that are particularly difficult. But so anyway, you'll need six grogs. Choose six grogs, and you could use the same stats but give them different names. There you go. Or you could just give them one of each and let them, yeah. Companions, you'll need one companion per player. But if they are going to be somebody's going to be playing their Magi, don't bother. Just give the other players companions. And there's a whole selection here: the knight, the rogue, the priest, the female scholar. Now, obviously, you don't need to use templates. You can create your own characters. But when you first start playing, understanding these templates will teach you the rules. And then you get into the mages templates, and they really are. They look horribly complicated. So I'm not going to go into too much detail on those for the moment. They add a couple of new things. Confidence. You confidence. There are two numbers there. One is the number of confidence points you've got. That's the second one. So, and the first one is the amount you can spend on any one roll. So confidence one with three means you, three times in the game, you can add +2 to a dice roll by spending a confidence point. That's all it means. It's that simple. Is it +2 or is it +3? Tom, can you hear
Which confidence?
+2, isn't it?
Plus three, Christian. Definitely plus three.
Oh, three, sorry. Yeah, okay. It's been a while. I've only run this for 20 years. But then I'm not a player, I'm the referee, and you can trust the players will spend their time adding up their totals. Most totals are pretty simple. So let's say, for example, that the character look at the ex miscellanea. No, look at the flambeau. Let's look at the flambeau. So the flambeau is on page 25, and they are going to try and cast a spell. But before they do that, they're making their way across some mountains, and they hear the roar of what they suspect is some kind of horrible panther. Now, they've never actually seen a panther, but that's what they imagine this thing is. Whatever it is, it's hiding in the rocks just around the corner on the trail. Sadly, there's a cliff on one side of them that goes all the way down into a valley far below, and there's a steep cliff up on the right. But luckily, there are more rocks. The question is, can the magician, or can she, decide to hide until such a time as the panther departs? So this character's got area lore 2, hiding places. They might know a hidden trail that would take them around the panther. Let's say they've been this way before. So they roll their intelligence, which is plus 2. So you add plus 2 to a dice roll. You add your area lore, which is 2. So that's plus 4. And they get a bonus point because the thing in brackets, hiding places, is clearly appropriate. And they're trying to find a hiding place where they can hide on this mountain. They roll a dice and add a total of 5, one for the hiding places, 2 for the area lore, and 2 for the intelligence. So roll a d10, try and get 5 or more. And if they roll a total of 9, so if they roll 4 or more on the dice when they've added 5, then they will usually succeed. 9 is often the difficulty. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower even, but 9 is the average. So let's say on this occasion they only roll 2. She doesn't know a hiding place. At this point, the panther, which is small, black, with a pink tongue, green eyes, comes round the corner and meows ferociously at them. Now, the flambeau has clearly never seen a cat before. It's not a panther, it's a small domesticated cuddles kitten, but it is coming bounding towards them. So they decide they're going to run for it. And so they take their dexterity, which is 0, and they take their athletics, which is 2, total of plus 2, with a bonus of plus 1 because running is their speciality, the thing in brackets, plus 3. They roll a dice, they get a 6. At this time, the poor kitten is left mooling to itself while the magi runs all the way back to the inn down the pass. Fair summary of the system, Tom? I think Tom has disappeared. There are also, as well as those abilities, there are some new skills here that you need to know about, things like Parma Magica. The real problem with being a magician, apart from the fact everybody hates you, is that it's very easy for your character to cast spells on somebody else and kill them. So, how do you prevent your character from coming to a bad end? Well, Parma Magica is literally magic shield. That's what it means. And you can use it to protect yourself from other people's magic. And it works pretty well. It's usually a good defense. Parma Magica 1 doesn't give you a huge amount of resistance, but you're not allowed to teach that skill to anyone who's not a member of the Order of Hermes. So when your character starts the game, that's all you're going to have. Tom, are you there?
I'm still here.
You're still here. For some reason, I can't hear you. Okay, Tom, can you explain the arm?
I keep getting the connections unstable appearing.
Okay. Can you try explaining the arts quickly? The bit on the character sheet. We're looking at the character.
So, magic arts.
Yeah, just explain the
Yeah,
magical.
magic arts. You've got five things to explain doing this hit. Are you creating it? Are you destroying it? Changing it? Understanding it? Controlling it? And then 10 other ones to join with it for what sort of thing you're affecting. So the flambeau, they like creating fires. So you cray out,
wow,
you take your cray, you take your ignat, which represents fires, add the two together, and that gives you an idea of how good you are at casting your favorite fire-based spells. And if you need to spontaneously cast it, that gets you a bit tired, and you divide the royal die, add it on, divide that by two to see what kind of level you actually get.
So let's have a look at Offlumbo on here and see what kind of spells she can cast at the beginning, because she's a typical starting character, a reasonably well-designed one. So if we look at the example characters again, which are on page... What page are we on? Right about 20, isn't it? So we'll find Offlumbo, which is on page 25 of the PDF or the book. Okay. Let's call her Lucy. Lucy, the Flumbo, is on the right-hand column. So she's going to cast a fireball. She's got Creo, CR is short for Creo, which means I create, of 12. She's got Ignem of 12 plus 3, so 15. Don't worry about the 12 plus 3. It's just because the way the rules work, the bonus is added on because it's, yeah, we don't need to explain it. It's down to experience points. But she's got an ignem of 15, so her total is 27. You add her stamina, which is plus 2, which gives you 29. And we'll assume she's not in any kind of magical or dominion aura, nothing that changes the effectiveness of magic. So she's got a base 29. Actually, let's assume she's in a basic covenant with an aura of 3. Most covenants have got a magic aura of 3. That takes her up to 32. If she shouts and uses a loud voice, Tom, use a loud voice and shout Creo Ignem. It wasn't as loud as me, but it'll do. Yep. That gives you plus 1. And if you gesticulate wildly and wave your arms, now the problem with that is that anybody who sees you doing these things will know full well that you're casting a spell if you use wild gestures and shout loudly. Many years ago, 20 odd years ago, or more than that, 25 years ago, my then girlfriend had a sign up in our living room which said, "Don't forget to shout and wave," because we were playing round the table, we would enforce the rule that players cast a spell. If they were casting it quietly, they had to whisper and, you know, not use gestures. And if they were casting it loudly, they should wave their arms. But it gives you a bonus of plus 2. So we've got plus 2 for shouting and waving, plus 2 for stamina, that's 4. Plus 3 for the aura, total of plus 7. Plus the Creo Ignem, which is 27. 7 plus 27 is a total of 34. We roll a dice. And what do we get? We get a 6. So that's a total of 40. And that will easily let you cast Arc of Fiery Ribbons, Ball of Abysmal Flame, which is a fireball, Circle of Encompassing Flames. You can see the known spells at the bottom. And you can invent your own spells. And that's what the beautiful bit about Ars Magica is you can try anything you want, but your chances of doing it are down to your skill in different magical forms, of which, you know, the 15 forms, well, 10 forms, 5 techniques. So at the end of the day, I'm trying to work out why she's got plus 41, because she's also got a virtue and flaw that alters the results. Virtues and flaws can give you really big bonuses to casting spells. So let's just quickly look so I can find that. Oh, here we go. She's got affinity with Ignem. That means she gets more magic. She gets more experience points. Affinity with Creo, yeah. Poissant Ignem, which costs plus 2, I think, to casting rolls. Necessary condition, must clap his hands. So she would have to clap her hands before she cast any spell. Luckily, she's got a greater immunity to fire. Major magical focus flames. So how that works is you take the higher of the two, in this case 15, divide it by 2, and add it again to the total. So you give a total value of 7, so she'd got 44. Yeah, basically, your starting magician can conjure half a dozen fireballs and take out a charging group of knights. Is that fair, Tom? So essentially, any monster that you throw at them you can build a first level character that can almost annihilate. One of the things which is important about Ars Magica is that magic is really powerful, and that you can do things that in other games would be more the province of superpowers. But it comes down to clever players using their magic to good effect. Anyway, we seem to be dropping out. I don't know if this is recording with Tom or not, but if he comes back, Tom, can you get back?
I think so.
So we've talked about Ars Magica. What's the first rule of Ars Magica if you bought the bundle of holding?
Tell everyone about Ars Magica.
Well, yeah. Tell everyone about Ars Magica. Second rule then is go ahead and play the game. If you don't try and play it, you'll never learn it. And for next week, we're going to be talking about story floors, but I'm also going to make an effort to create a website that does the maths for you so that you can calculate the level of any spell. Because I think that would just be a really handy thing for players to have. What do you reckon?
Yep, always useful.
So I'm not sure I can create a phone app, but I can certainly create a JavaScript page where you can go to it and just quickly calculate your spell levels. So hopefully I'll get that done for next week. If not, you can blame Tom because he'll have distracted me with evil board games and another game of Ark Nova. But for tonight, that's good night from Chris and it's good night from
That's
Tom.
good for me.
Good night, Tom. Good night.
Good night.